In a room full of men, always be the woman.
What is up, team? You have to get ready for our new episode and maybe my new favorite episode on the show. And as you can tell, it's going to be an English one again. So I'm going to start out with a short message for all my German listeners. Listen, just give it a try, please, okay? Because trust me, I feel like everyone needs to hear this one in order to get a glimpse of our new team members' literally unmatched energy. She puts it all just so incredibly well into words. Her vision for women's football is impeccable and her story simply so inspiring. She is the first woman to sell a startup in football, of which Serena Williams' husband was main investor, by the way, but she will share the whole story with us herself. She has lived all over the world, speaks four languages. She really knows what it means to power through getting almost 150 no's and rejections. What it means to truly believe in yourself. She shares her thoughts on feminine and masculine energy, pregnancy even, and why women's football is not just nice to have, but an incredible business case. So get ready for this rock star now and enjoy the episode. Welcome to the team, Victoire Kojevina Reynal. This episode was post-produced by Axon Media. Does sound nice, and also I need a little bit of explanation about that one. What do you mean by saying that you are the woman? What do you mean by be the woman?
So I think I've spent now over a decade working in football in rooms, offices, building offices, stadiums filled with men, mm-hmm. and it's very tempting when you're in those situations to become a man and to behave like one. Mm-hmm. And with the years and with maturity and experience, I've found that behaving like a woman was my superpower. And being a woman was my superpower in that context.
Oh my God, I love this. And maybe you can share with us what that means to you. How do you behave like a woman?
So, I mean, I think the world is perfect, right? In the sense that there's women, there's men, and we're complementary in many different ways. And, you know, women are very much web thinkers when men are more linear thinkers. And you need both to get great work done, right? And I think that when we're, you know, constantly trying to be a man, trying to be more assertive or more aggressive in certain ways or more in the doing, we forget that other side of us, that web thinking part, the one that is considering emotions, is considering people's input, is thinking about multiple things at the same time, and essentially making or, you know, creating conclusions that might be a lot more powerful than if we're just in the role of a man. And so to me, it's, you know, everything from like wear the heels, wear the makeup, wear the feminine outfit. You don't need to look like a man to be taken seriously, all the way to, you know, bring your sensitivity, bring your softness, bring your, you know, your emotional intelligence into the conversation, because it, at the end of the day, it makes it so much more powerful.
I love this so much. You can't even imagine. And it makes me think of one thing. I can't remember her name. She's a very famous actress. If I said the name, you would be like, oh yes, I know her. She was sitting in a panel discussion and she was speaking about, you know, the acting industry and Hollywood. And she would go like, I always thought that I would have to work towards becoming part of the boys club. And then she realized it's not about becoming part of the boys' club. It's realizing how powerful the girls' club is and being proud of each other in this girls' club. So it's absolutely definitely exactly that. Oh my God, what a start already. I'm in love with this. I'll definitely remember this as my own motto from now on.
Please.
And of course, we have to still introduce you to our listeners so they know who is the woman in the room full of men. So welcome, first of all, Victoire Kojevina Reynal. I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly. Tough
yes,
one.
Yes, you did. I know. Took me years to learn my own name, so don't worry.
Perfect. And before we actually dig deep into the conversation, our team members, that's the way I call my guests here, always get to introduce themselves a little bit like on a FIFA card, like, you know, with your skills up there, but you can freely choose what you put on it. What would be on your card, Vic?
Awesome. I like this. So yes, my name, Victoire, French name, but I'm actually half Greek, half Argentinian, born in the United States, lived in over 11 different cities. My father was an ambassador, that's why. And football has been my passion since I was a very little girl. It's become my way of connecting with people every time I moved around, every time I learned a new language. I was lucky enough, and I've said this many times, that my older brother took me to the stadium with him in Argentina. And I discovered the power of this sport and really started thinking how I could become less of an alien in those spaces and more of a common thing. And so years later, I began my career in football, not really wanting it. It just happened. I studied fashion. I worked in fashion at first. And then one day my mother called me to invite me to start an agency with her representing Latin American players in the Major League Soccer, so in the MLS, which was something that, you know, if you know my mother, is not a crazy thing to say for her, but obviously, you know, in another wider context it was, especially 10 years ago where there were really no women whatsoever doing this job, with some exception, but they were directly related to the players. They were the mothers of the players or their wives or their aunts. And so we started this agency, SR All Stars, based in Miami. And I remember on my second week of work there, I was like, I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life to this sport. I love it. Like, this is incredible. There's so many different things that can be better. And so my entrepreneurial self was like, okay, we can fix this and this and this and this. And so it took me on a journey that was, that has been and continues to be very unpredictable. I think that there's a common thread in all of the different things I've done so far, which has been, you know, going on some territory that has never been walked on before, especially as a woman, but as well, not as a woman. And so my second venture in football was a tech company that I started in San Francisco, in Silicon Valley, becoming the first football company in the space. There, right? In the world, in the place where all the tech companies were changing the world, football wasn't represented, and I didn't understand why. Fast enough, I guess. Soon enough, I did understand that Americans didn't see the power of football just yet. And so I went through that process. I raised money from some incredible investors, including Alexis Ohanian, who today is also the founder and owner of Angel CDFC. And some other incredible investors as well. And then after a 4.5 year journey, we sold to our biggest competitor, One Football, a German company that I know you're very familiar with. and so that basically became the end of that journey for me. And now more than ever, more focused on women's football. It's been also a thread in my career to speak up for women, as I was, you know, as we said in the beginning of the podcast, you know, being the only woman in the room, made it for the press to be very interested in my story and for other women to kind of look at me and say, okay, well, if she can do it, then I can do it as well. And so, I really took that responsibility very seriously. At the beginning, I didn't. I hated being on stage. I hated, like, I'm like, why?
Really?
I did. I remember it's like they're only interviewing me because I'm a woman. I was like, I want them to interview me when I do something. Like, I want them to interview me when I and to ask me about my work, not about my gender. And I guess I was in my early 20s when I said I was saying that, and then I realized that the world works in a different way, and also could see, you know, how other women were really impacted by my story in ways that, you know, I've still until the day of today, there's women that have been in football for 5-6 years and they only got into it because they heard my story somewhere. And they send me messages and they say thank you. And, you know, all those things to me mean a lot. And so anyways, my kind of role in football has, without me wanting it, became a bit of a representation of women and, you know, young women as well, feminine women as well, like all of these different labels. And so, yeah, it's been quite the roller coaster. But I've, you know, since realizing that responsibility, I started working with the United Nations as an ambassador for gender equality in football. Very, very exciting job. And then, you know, being a very vocal activist for it wherever I can. I consider myself a businesswoman, a business person. And to me, it's about looking at the future of football and realizing that, you know, for 100 years, we left women out. And we built, sold, marketed an entire sport that touches half the world without really thinking what it would look like if it touched the other half of the world. And so today, you know, and I think that the next 20, 30 years of my life are definitely going to be, you know, making sure that I answer that question and that we find a way to tap into this market that to me is a $1 trillion opportunity that comes, you know, once in a generation. So as a business person, I'm very excited as well. So yeah, I'm going to stop there. I mean, I could speak a lot more.
Quite the packed, you know, little introduction to begin with, for sure. Very tough to pick on or to start in a specific way. But let me actually take it back to the very beginning, because you tapping into football, tapping into the sports industry, didn't seem to be as obvious as it might look right now. You said you studied fashion, you were in fashion, and then your mom comes up and goes, let's found this agency together, which, you know, as you said, was very a huge leap forward, leap of faith, basically, back in the days, especially in the US, where, as you said, the sports is not as famous or popular as it is over here in Europe. And you said, knowing your mother, it probably doesn't sound as crazy. Dig a little bit deeper for us into that area. Who is your mom? What does she do, and how did she pull off this incredible idea of starting this agency?
I love it. I have a very big smile on my face for those that can't see me right now. My mother is amazing. Her name is Shalimar Reynal, Argentinian. Her father and mother as well, Argentinian. And she, from a very young age, I think, like, was born with a different chip in her head where gender wasn't really a thing for her. She never saw it as a obstacle or as a disability or as anything. She was like, I'm just a woman, and that's all that there is to it. And at the very young age of 18 years old, she decided to become a commercial pilot. And my grandfather was he owned an airline in Argentina, the first private airline, Austral, and she wanted to work for him. And so at that point, there were no women in Latin America that were commercial pilots. And my grandfather really didn't take her seriously. He said, yeah, sure, try. I don't think you're going to succeed. And she did. And I think that, you know, being 19 and, like, being able to do something that hard kind of changes your whole mindset around life. And so later on, she started working in wealth management and, you know, worked in banking and finance for a long time, another very saturated, you know, male-dominated industry. And I guess, you know, very naturally, very organically, once she started her own wealth management firm, a lot of football players were kind of becoming her clients. And she always cared about people. Again, you know, when I say, like, be a woman in a room full of men, like, she would always go the extra mile. She'll always try and understand her clients in a deeper way. They were not just numbers for her on an Excel spreadsheet. And so having conversations with her clients and their wives, she started kind of seeing this pattern where a lot of Latin American players really wanted to go to play to the MLS. Like, once they couldn't make it really into the Premier League or any of their European leagues, they were like, okay, the next best thing is the MLS. And but they didn't really understand how to do it. And their agents also didn't understand how to do it, because the MLS is obviously very different in its structuring and its laws and its and everything, really. And so, you know, for a player and for an agent that are used to European football or even South American football, it becomes like a really complicated thing that can then end up in really bad situations where, you know, players sign contracts without understanding what they're doing, et cetera, et cetera. And so the whole idea started from there. She's like, look, I see this problem. We are, you know, and the way that she pitched it to me, she said, you know, you and I were not that different from players and their wives. You know, we're like the wives. We've traveled around with your father. We had to, like, you know, change
homes. Interesting way to see it. Yeah.
We had to change homes and, you know, and languages and countries. And so we can understand, you know, where they're coming from. And I think that we can add a lot of value in being also cultural translators of sorts. Like, you know, we studied in the US, but we are Argentinian and we speak both languages. And so all of this different kind of, you know, factors that made her come up with a very compelling argument. And on top of it, I mean, obviously being my mother and someone I looked up to a lot my whole life, she had taught me the same thing. She was like, don't you ever dare use your gender to, like, say that you can do or not do something. Like, the biggest sin that you could commit in our house. And so when she said it, I didn't think, oh, I'm a woman, maybe it's not going to work out. You know, I didn't think that. I was like, oh, sure. I mean, I love football, and I was getting really tired of fashion, which, funnily enough, it's like the opposite. It's like a women's, female saturated industry, right? And so I was like, I don't like this. And I really wanted to be entrepreneurial in whatever I was doing and not work for someone. And so it was a very easy yes. But little did we know that it was going to be the hardest thing that we ever did.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, I mean, at first, nobody took us seriously. I think that they just saw, like, a mother and a daughter, blonde, walking in an office. And my mother has, like, a very strong presence. And, you know, she's a beautiful woman. And they would look at us and they're like, who are these two strange things talking to us about football? And, you know, they just wouldn't take us seriously. And then, you know, we kind of managed to become successful because we were very powerful on the player side rather than on the club side. So we managed to build really beautiful relationship with some of the players that, you know, we represented. You know, in most cases we're intermediaries, so we didn't represent the player, but we just made sure that the deal was done. But even in those particular examples, like, we would have a relationship with the player, their wife, their kids, and we really wanted to make sure that wherever they went, it was a good fit for them, which also gave them a lot of longevity in their clubs.
Emotional intelligence.
Exactly, yeah. And so I think players, like, kind of saw through that very fast, and they started telling their colleagues and their, you know, other teammates, hey, these two, they're not as bad as they look. You should try working with them. And so, but it took
as they look.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it took a long time. We lost a lot of deals. We lost a lot of deals as well, because, I mean, this is no secret, but the player representation industry is one of the most unregulated, unprofessional, dirty, you know, sectors of football, which I always say I'm so glad I started there, because I started in the worst place. There's nothing worse than that. And I learned a lot. It was like this kind of boot camp, MBA, kind of come here, I'll show you what football really is. And as a fan, you kind of, you lose a lot. Like, it's so heartbreaking. You're like, no. You go and watch a game and you're like, oh, if everyone knew what it took to take that, get that player on the pitch, like, they wouldn't love their club any, as much as they do. So yeah. That's,
and I can imagine that from this point of view, from this realization, basically, you started the idea for Gloria, mm-hmm. no?
Mm-hmm. So, look, I think there's, and I've kind of answered this question more genuinely, I guess, in the last few months only, because, you know, there's obviously a part of me that understood that the application of technology to football would be a very beneficial thing. You know, every industry in the world had moved online, but football. Like, it's just, and it made no sense. I remember speaking to clubs and telling them about Instagram, where when Instagram already had 100 million users, okay? Not like, we're not talking that they were like very small, but 100 million users. And clubs was like, oh my God, no, we don't need that. And now they run.
And this is like, I don't know, 6 years ago
exactly,
or something.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. And now they run the whole business on Instagram. And so I really, you know, do believe, I still believe that the application of technology is very beneficial. There's obviously many of them. And now we're seeing them kind of grow exponentially. But there was the other side of it, which is something that I think I didn't even realize until very recently. And that's why I've started answering this question this way. But being an agent is providing a service. And there was something inside of me that hated only making money when I provided a service. Like, I wanted to make money when I was sleeping. That was my thing. And I feel like women are not very comfortable about talking about their financial ambitions. And so I said, you know what? That's the truth. Like, I really knew that tech would be a good business, a business that, again, would touch and be a lot more scalable than any service providing type of business. And that ultimately it was going to make me rich. I mean, that was a very plain truth. And I really strongly believe that we should be more vocal about that. There's nothing wrong with women wanting to make money.
Why do you think women are not at that place yet? I don't feel like, I personally wouldn't think of one lady, one girl in my friend group or network or whatever who would feel comfortable saying like, yeah, but I just want to be rich.
Well, I mean, look, I say this, but I'm also like a UN ambassador for gender equality. I do a lot of nonprofit work. I do a lot of advocacy. Nobody pays me for it, you know, and I think that women are kind of expected because of their nature, you know, their motherly nature, their nurturing nature. They are expected to leave on this earth to provide provide love and, you know, comfort, and to be there not to change the world, to break the rules, to make billions of dollars. Like, that's for the men. That's the men do that. The women, they fix things, they make them look pretty and beautiful, and again, I think that the combination is very powerful. But the reality is that in every woman, there's a little bit of a man. And in every man, there's a little bit of a woman as well, right? Like, that is those energies. Like, I mean, there's plenty of studies that show that they cohabitate. And, you know, society until very recently just made it impossible for us to say something like this out loud. Because it was just that you were a housewife, you stayed at home, you, like, the biggest honor of your life would be to marry a man and to raise your kids and be a mother. But that was it. And in the last, you know, 30, 40 years, that has changed dramatically. where, you know, we see a whole new generation of women, which, you know, I have a younger sister, she's 19 years old, where it's like, in her, there's no, like, in her mind, she's gonna go to college, she's gonna get an education, she's gonna get a high-paying job, and she's not gonna wait for a man to come save her. And it's just like that. And I know, and I'm pregnant right now. I'm 8 months pregnant with a little girl.
Congrats, yes.
Thank you.
A girl. Yeah. How could you not have a girl?
Exactly. I always say that. I was like, there was no other option here. No. But I know that she will live in a world where it's even more, you know, it's even more...
Normal.
Yeah, not even normal, but it's just, it's going to be expected from women to be a part of society in a way that they had never been for like 1,000 years, you know? So it's like, it's a very new thing. We and I have to remind this to myself a lot, you know, when, you know, when I see, you know, injustices and inequalities and like, just like different access and seeing how women, you know, constantly, and I am no exception of that rule, just like their starting line is not the same as men. I have to remind myself that 2000 years plus, you know, women had a role in society, and in the last 100 it's changed. And I, you know, a lot of people can argue that it only changed in the last 50, really, not even 100. And so obviously, you know, we want everything right now, and but it takes a long time to change that perception. And but I'm going to do as much as I can in my lifetime to change it.
And you're doing a great job so far. And I would love for you to tell us more about the app that you made out of, you know, out of this vision that you had for yourself. And I actually listened to another podcast preparing for our conversation here. And you said at one point, and then I moved to San Francisco because that was the best place to do it. And I was like, wow. And she just says that so casually, like it's nothing. Like that's just what you do. Pick a random spot and then go without knowing anyone.
Yeah, it wasn't
How
easy.
Did the whole thing happen? Yeah.
It wasn't easy. So Gloria had many different shapes. It began as a scouting platform. So it really was born from trying to resolve a problem where there was a ton of incredible talent that was totally uncovered, and scouting systems around the world.
Just for women's football?
No.
Women's scouting?
No, it was for both. For both. Yeah. At that time, women's football like wasn't really a thing at all. So it was mostly men. But yeah, it came from trying to fix this issue where there was a lot of talented players, especially in the US, that were kind of hidden from the system, rather because in the US it was a pay-to-play problem. So if you were from a lower income family, then you were never going to be able to play football. In places like Argentina, you know, the further away from the capital you were, the harder it was to get in front of a scout. And so, you know, at that point, we all had these devices, right? These mobile phones, these smartphones. And in my mind, it was very clear. It's like, if we can use this device to empower these players around the world to film themselves and to be able to put themselves in front of clubs and agents and scouters, et cetera, then we will build a much better world, right? So a visibility platform more than anything else. And that concept took a long time to develop and to build into a product that would be usable by our audience, right? So I really wanted to make sure it was a social experience, that, you know, people were getting very used to Instagram at that point and Twitter, and like, how can we build a consumer product that has this like very specific aim, which is to connect players with clubs. And so it took some time. We then raised money. It took a long time to convince American investors of this. And then once we were ready to start like really building, the pandemic hit us. It hit the entire world.
And impeccable timing.
Yeah, exactly. And I will say, at that point, you know, obviously players weren't playing. Like, they weren't really playing with their friends or teammates, so they couldn't really film themselves. And like, I mean, there was the challenges going on with toilet paper and stuff like that, but it wasn't really something, you know. Yeah. And funnily enough, like, it was a great moment in football because, like, clubs realized the power of online with the pandemic. They were like, oh my God, we can't rely on ticket sales anymore, and we can't, like, have this super expensive, like, scouting system where we need to fly people around the world, and, like, we should look at online, you know, solutions. But at that point, we had to quickly pivot, obviously, as any startup, and, like, start thinking a little bigger. And so one of the big problems that was going on was that, you know, football fans were missing football so much. I mean, including myself, right?
Yes, like, clearly.
Yeah, it was, I mean, we forget, but, like, it was months and months with no football, and it was so sad. Like, it was one of the things where you're like, wow, this thing really adds a lot to my life, and I don't have it anymore, and I can't go to a stadium, and I can't, you know, talk about it with my friends. And so we said, okay, what about we build a community, again, a consumer product, social-based, for football fans, and move away from players to focus on fans. And then once we can build that community, we'll go back to the players as things go back to normal. I mean, obviously, we didn't know how long things would take. And so Gloria ended up being this, right? The world's largest football community on one place, right? Where if you were a fan of any team in the world, you could come, you can find other fans, and you can connect with them. And, you know, the very big vision for it was to recreate that stadium experience in the app. So a stat that I came across that broke my heart, is that 98% of fans never get to step a foot in the stadium. 98% of fans, yeah.
No.
Because of financial reasons, because of location, et cetera. 98. And even though 98% of fans never get to experience what it is to be inside a stadium, there's still 3.5 billion football fans in the world. And so my whole vision there was, okay, how can I make these people feel closer, as much a closer to this game as possible? And funnily enough, that was a tagline of One Football: no one gets you closer.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, my God. Match made in heaven, kind of.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, I always tell Lucas, the CEO and founder of One Football, that I was very much inspired by what One Football had done. I think, you know, that there was a difference where One Football was a lot more about delivering news and, like, building a place where you could consume about football and less about community. And we were, like, the other extreme, where it's like we're only about community. And, like, if you want to read about your team, that you can do it through your community. So whatever they're posting about the team and whatever they're thinking, and user-generated content, essentially, as opposed to just, you know, big publishers that have been in the business for years. And so, yeah, Gloria, by the time it sold to One Football, that's what it was trying to do. I think a lot of people think of Gloria and think of women's football because we really...
True, I do too.
yeah, I love it. I think it's great. And it was a purposeful thing that happened where, you know, women's football was beginning to, you know, kind of grow quite a lot. And we were like, look, we're building this product. And me, as selfishly as a fan that is a woman, I was like, I just want to make sure that I don't feel, again, not really talked to by a brand. So I'm like, when we're building the brand, I build it with a bunch of guys, which I adore, but it was a bunch of guys. And I was like, look, guys, like, every brand under the sun building for football, whether it's an apparel brand or it's a club, or it's so masculine. And I'm not saying, like, let's do everything pink, but let's do something in the middle where it's like, as a woman, I can feel identified and spoken to.
Yeah.
And so the crazy thing was that the more we got into that type of mentality, the more successful we would be, and the more deals we would get, and, you know, the more commercial, you know, partners we would, you know, come into on board. And it obviously became very clear that there was such a massive gap in the market for it that we were, like, kind of the first in there. And it made me very proud because, I mean, as a woman myself, I was like, this is amazing. I get to, like, do something I've always wanted. And so even though it was for everyone, you know, Gloria, and also, I mean, the name Gloria, right? It means glory in Spanish, la gloria del fútbol, the glory of football. But it's also a female name, which I loved, and also beyond one of the biggest feminists of our generation, Gloria Steinem, as well. So to me, it was like the name was perfect, and then it just like all fell into place in a very beautiful way.
And then how did it make you feel selling your baby that just, you know, became this perfect product of all your visions and, you know, came into real life, selling that to your biggest competitor?
It's a,
I mean,
yeah,
has to feel great because, you know, the other part of making money in your dreams, now you can
exactly.
check that box as well. But
exactly,
it's emotional, no?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think that, you know, selling a company for any entrepreneur is a very bittersweet situation because it's a win. Of course, it's a win. But it's also a loss. It's also a loss. But I think that in our particular case, it was very straightforward. We knew we would be stronger with OneFootball. We knew that, you know, OneFootball had been in the race for 15 years. We had only been in that race for 4. And if anything, our mission and vision was going to be accelerated by a million. You know, and so I came to terms with that decision when I realized that, you know, selling to OneFootball would mean for me to get into a time machine and travel 15 years ahead of time, 10 years ahead of time, and
nice.
Just get out.
Okay, get it.
And so to me, it was as long as the vision and the mission was the same, which it was and it is, then there was no harm. And doing it still, obviously difficult because you gotta let go of a lot of things. I mean, the Gloria brand was sunsetted, which also broke my heart. But you know, it was part of the bigger picture of this idea that football fans deserve much better than what they're getting right now. And OneFootball has been working on this for so long, and we, you know, we gave our own little grain of sand. And I think it also a good segue into me realizing that there is a time in every business where it's a perfect time to do something. Mm-hmm. And those windows, they come they're very small and they come not very often. And so I saw the women's football window open and I said, you know, with everything I've done in my career, with everything I've learned so far, it'd be a pity if I didn't, you know, really put 100% of my time in trying to fix this problem and trying to make it more accessible, fun, more sexy, more mainstream, and like really get the other half of the world on board. And so at the end of the day, it worked out really well. That's all I'm going to say.
Congrats again.
Thank you.
And one thing that comes up, speaking about this, and it's like a double question also going back to your pitching time for investors in the very beginning, negotiating is one super important thing. Negotiating your salary could be, you know, out there for anyone, but negotiating basically the worth of your company is a big thing. And then, so I'm making two questions out of this. How do you approach an important negotiation? And how did you convince Alexis Ohanian to invest in Gloria back in the days?
How do I approach a negotiation? So I have around me some very powerful women that I've learned a lot about negotiating. My mother being the first one, and then my head of comms, Ola Ale, I'm going to say hello to her, they're just like masterclass of negotiation. Just incredible. And so I've learned a lot from them because I was a really bad negotiator. I think like as a woman, we're naturally bad negotiators because we're always like, oh, we don't want to take too much. We don't want to ask for too much because, and I think that the best kind of way to look at it, at least for me, was I had great evidence that I had been successful in the past at getting whatever I wanted. And so I didn't have to be scared moving forward. Obviously, yes, that doesn't work for someone that just is starting in a career. But knowing your worth and believing in your worth is the starting line, right? And so this is what I'm worth. And now I'm going to tell you exactly why I'm worth all of this. And if you don't agree, well, am I ready to lose this deal or whatever, this acquisition, or am I ready to walk away from it? And I think, like, just doing a very quick 5-minute, 10-minute mental exercise where, like, this is what I want, this is what I don't want, these are the non-negotiables, like, if I don't get this, then there's no deal, and when am I ready to walk away from this? And I think that knowing that gives you a lot of power. It's also scary and daunting, but it gives you a lot of power. And then the last thing I'd say, which is something I learned from reading Steve Jobs' biography, is that he always said that negotiations need to happen over email. And so all my biggest negotiations never happened in a room. They happened over email. Because I think it gives you a lot more time to react, a lot more time to think. And at the end of the day, it becomes a lot more objective and not emotional. Where that's where it can get really tough, right? Where, like, someone is attacking your emotions and you're like, okay, whatever. This situation is so uncomfortable. I'll give you whatever you want. And so, yeah. And actually, I have to also mention my lawyer, Ben Walcott, who has been, like, he's always been by my side since day one, and he's taught me a lot about negotiating, a lot, in a very diplomatic way as well. Yeah, so mentors and knowing what you want and what you don't want and knowing your worth. So it's a complicated beast.
The email thing hits so hard right now because I'm not a talking on the phone person. I don't enjoy talking on the phone very much. And usually people go, let's negotiate over the phone. And I'm always, like, you know, hesitant or, like, cringy because exactly what you just described would happen. I'm just like, yeah, okay, yeah, fine, whatever. So I always thought negotiating over email is like me being not strong enough doing it over the phone.
But exactly what you were saying.
Interesting. Yeah. It's so interesting. I didn't know.
Yeah, no, Steve absolutely. Jobs, it's really, like, some people disagree with this approach. Mostly men will disagree with this approach. But I think that even, you know, we're talking about discussing a salary. I learned this from, like, a family friend who works in HR. And she said the same. She's like, everything over email. Like, you want it written, right? When you're negotiating your salary. And she's like, one of the ways that you can make sure that you're getting paid fairly is ask a very simple question over email. Am I making the same as my male counterparts in this company? And so as a company, they cannot say yes if it's a no. And so what happens is that every single time I've used it, I've only used it once, I will say, I just got a massive bump on my salary, just magically. Not like they didn't even answer my question. They're like, oh, we'll give you, like, whatever, $30,000 more. So,
interesting.
Yeah, that's if you're a woman out there trying to negotiate your salary, especially in Europe where things are a little more backward, use this one. It's a good one.
That is one crazy hint. I hope everyone takes notes right now. And let's move a little bit further into this because, you know, we've been talking a lot about Gloria per se, a lot about football. And I feel like at some point you switched from just being a football fan in general to being a female football fan. What happened there? And how do you see the, you know, women's football in our days? Easy question. Very small one, right?
Yeah. I want to make it succinct. Look, I think that as I was saying earlier on, you know, this is a sport that was never meant for women. And now there's a window opening where it can become for women. And if it does, it just means that this is going to explode in a way that no one can even, not even myself, can imagine at this point. You know, we know female consumers are a lot more powerful than male consumers. We spend a lot more money. And we make decisions for a lot more people in the household as well, which basically means that women, you know, have a power of changing the consumption of the sport in a way that we can't imagine right now. Now, you know, how do you fix a sport, an experience, in a way that makes sense for women, right? And I think that's a question that I'm asking myself right now. I'm very interested in it. It's also going to be my next step in my career. There's a foundational problem before replicating products and services in football for women, whether it's a scores app or, you know, a women's football team or a jersey for women. There's a much bigger foundational challenge, which is the societal perception that there is around women in football. Even though in some places this has changed, women in football are not synonyms in any way, shape, or forms. It's actually the opposite. If you're a woman and you love football, you're usually considered manly, like a little bit of a tomboy, a little bit of an outcast. You're not like supposed to be feminine in like football. That just like, that's a no-no. Your opinion is just worthless. You as a fan, you're worthless. Which it's kind of like funny because female fans are actually worth a lot more. For a club than males. And like actually only a few days ago I went to the semi-finals of the Women's Champions League. I went to a Chelsea stadium. I live like a 5-minute walk from it, and so I've been very lucky to go to a lot of men's and women's games. And one thing I noticed just the other day was the queues to get into the merchandise store were insane. But I'm not joking, they were like, the security guy was like, it's going to take about 45 minutes to get into the shop. And the game was starting in 10 minutes. Nobody gave a shit. Sorry.
No, you can swear.
Yeah, okay, good. Nobody gave a shit. They were like, we want the jersey. We don't care about the match kind of thing. So I think that like really changing that perception ultimately is going to be the key to unlocking this massive audience that is just waiting to become a part of the sport. You know, right now, like obviously women's football have fans. They have been filling stadiums around the world, not only in Europe, also in the United States and South America, you know, and in Asia. Like we've seen record-breaking attendances and it's amazing. But how do you build that into a sustainable business model in the future? And I think it's firstly, you know, changing this perception and making it cool for your normal girlfriend to just go to a stadium or to speak about her friends about the match over the weekend or to know who the players are on the pitch or to wear a jersey. I mean, we saw Kim Kardashian wore like a jersey. Uh-huh. I think it was like Napoli or I don't remember what Italian team. Roma.
She probably doesn't remember either. She wore it for fashion.
Exactly. And she wore it. And then like in 30 minutes, it was sold out everywhere in the world. It was like a vintage jersey. So, you know, there's...
I think it was Roma, no?
Yeah,
Red and gold. Whatever.
Anyway, the point of this is that, you know, you can have someone like her that doesn't care. I mean, she then also went to an Arsenal match and it was crazy. And like, so I think that, you know, showing that and like working in a concerted effort, because that's the difference here. A lot of clubs, a lot of, you know, tournaments and leagues and even federations and confederations and like brands, do their little things here and there to like change this mentality. You know, we've seen Heineken be at the very kind of forefront of changing this mentality around women in football. But what about we make a concerted effort? Like, why about, what about we all work together to make this happen? And for me, it's really about developing intellectual property off pitch. So really not focusing on the matches, but everything outside, whether it's a TV show, whether it's a docuseries, whether it's, you know, the Drive to Survive of women's mm-hmm. football, where it's, you know, a merchandise line, a museum, like a experience. I mean, so many different ways of doing it, but all of these always through the lens of like, okay, let's teach this new generation that's coming, and existing generations as well, that like football and women are a totally normal thing. And not only it's normal, but it's cool and it's sexy and it's mainstream. Like, I want a group of girlfriends to say, like, instead of us going to have brunch, we're going to go to watch a game on the over the weekend.
Oh, and, like, I love this.
Who knows, maybe they meet the love of your life in the stadium, and then that yeah. becomes a thing. And like, so I think that, you know, that's really I guess going back to your original question, why I became more of a female football fan, it's just like so much opportunity. And ultimately, and this is where I get my nonprofit hat on, my activist hat on, if there is gender equality in football, like, it's undeniable. You cannot deny women anything else in the world. That's my humble opinion.
Oh my God. Like, I love every single sentence you're saying. I have to focus so much so that I don't miss a single word. Yeah, there's literally nothing we could add on to that. Preach, girl. I hope this becomes reality for real.
We're going to work on it together. Who knows?
Yes, we definitely are. And, you know, I have these little categories as well. And I'm just, usually you get to pick, like in a UCL draw or something. But I'm going to pick one for you right now because this just fits perfectly. It's a German word for like a throw-in.
Okay.
And this would be the category where you bring a topic to the stage, basically, that you feel needs some attention. Would that be exactly what you just said, or did you bring something else, maybe?
Well, a lot of things need attention in this world. Look, I think, and this comes from a personal experience, you know, we today, and it's no secret, live in a world that was built by men for men. Everything. From our houses to the public spaces that we use to the cars that we drive, you know, they were tested on men and made sure that they worked for men and not for women.
Medical and tests.
Everything.
All that, yeah, all everything. Those things.
It's actually, like, the more you look into it, the sadder it gets. There's this incredible book called Invisible Women that speaks about all the data behind it. And I really, reading that book, it opened my mind, and I said, that's crazy. Like, how is it possible that a woman is 47% more likely to die in a car accident because of the height of the fucking airbag? And so, you know, when you apply this, not only to football, but the world, the reason why this is happening is because there's no enough women in leadership positions making these types of decisions and, like, reminding, because sometimes it's just a question of reminding that we also are here and we're consumers. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think, and it might be sad, but we'll get the job done. Like, the second men realize the financial power that there is in adapting products to women, then that's gonna be over. But right now they're still like at the beginning of it. And so I've been in situations constantly where, you know, they're like, oh, we have to do women's football because it's the right thing to do. And I was like, no, man, it's the right business decision. It's not the right, I mean, it is the right thing to do, surely. If you have daughters, yeah, it's the right thing to do.
It's but, nice, but that's not the argument. That's not
exactly
the point. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I think that, you know, there's been obviously a massive push to put women in positions of leadership, but once they're there, they don't have power. They don't have power. And I've seen it.
Is that so?
Well, some of them have. Some of them have. It's not a blanket statement, but a lot of them don't. And it's heartbreaking because it's you lose all your agency. You're there and you want to make change and you're just like fighting and fighting and fighting the system and you're like, what for? Like, and so, you know, I guess my throw in would be, you know, if you're a man and you're listening to this, just like be a little more aware of the women that work with you. It doesn't matter if you're a manager, you're a CEO, if you're an entry level person, like the way that you behave with a woman, the way that you make her feel in a work environment, the way that you pause to hear, to really hear what she has to say, not just like nod and not listen or wait for your turn to speak. And just understanding that it's not like you're doing a favor to her. It's just going to be better for the business. So if you're serving women in any way, shape, or form, which most businesses around the world do, then you need to have that input. And if you silence these women or shame them or make them uncomfortable, even in the smallest ways, then you're never going to get to what really needs to be done. And so, you know, I hope that that changes. As I said, like went through it myself. And again, you know, I have everything on my side. You know, I have a very powerful woman as a mother. I, you know, been always fighting at the forefront, the face of, you know, this. I was the first woman to do the agency, the first woman to sell a company, all the first, and it's all great and nice. But to me, it serves no point if I'm the last. Like, it's just, it's just pointless. And so I think that even, you know, that I feel, and I'm sure I'm perceived as well as a very empowered woman. If I can feel like that, I don't even want to imagine women that have not had the chance that I've had in my lifetime. So hopefully that changes.
Wow, another power statement right here. But it also brings me back to the situation where you were speaking of mentors. You just mentioned your mom again. You also already mentioned your team, Ale, and your lawyer as well. And one of our categories is called head coach, which I love this one. It doesn't have to be a person that you're sharing with us maybe or that you're bringing up, but I would love for you to dig a little bit deeper here and share with us who or what has been or is your head coach in difficult situations, in moments of hardship, in, you know, predicaments that you feel that you can't get out of by yourself. Who or what do you turn to?
I mean, I have a team of incredible people around me. And, you know, at the beginning of my career, I believed that asking for help was wrong, that it would make me feel weaker or it made me feel like I didn't know what I was doing. And like, I quickly realized that was probably the stupidest thought I had ever had in my life. And so I started leaning a lot on a lot of different people that are just world-class at what they do. Another person that deserves a shout out is Robbie Crabtree. He's my storytelling coach, which is something that, you know, I naturally love to do.
Storytelling coach. Storytelling, oh my God.
Yeah. Storytelling, fundraising. I mean, it's just like speaking engagements, like just being able to portray ideas and to sell them and to paint a world that nobody can see right now, right? And I realized early on in my career that was a skill that I naturally had, but I like became obsessed with the idea of becoming the best in the world with it because I saw how powerful it was. I saw, you know, how, you know, I was able to convince people like Alexis Ohanian to invest in my company, where when I was like a first-time founder with no experience in tech, and storytelling was really it. Storytelling can change the world. Like there's no doubt about that. And so, you know, I have on the more professional side, you know, people like him helping me a lot. On the personal side, you know, I have an incredible support group. I think that's really important as well. Yeah. My best friends, my soon to be husband as well, who is incredible. He's a professional poker player. So I learned a lot about how he looks at the world as well, and how he makes decisions in high pressure situations, and how he keeps a poker face in a lot of different circumstances. He also uses humor in a magnificent way. So I've learned from that too. But I think ultimately, all of that is great. But if you don't believe in yourself, then nothing matters. Like no one will convince you of anything or will be able to help you in any way if you don't believe that you can do something, or you don't believe that you're right, or you don't believe that your view of the world is like worthy enough to be heard. And that is something that I struggled a lot with. And the second that I just realized that if I didn't believe in myself, like nobody else would, then I just changed that. And now I'm like, it's almost blind, where I'm like, I think I can do whatever I want. And I go into it like with a lot, like being very naive as well, right? It's like, oh, sure, I can produce a movie. Like that should be easy. And then like when I look back, same as like when I sold the company, I'm like, sure, I can sell the company. And like 6 months later, I'm like there with white hair. I'm like, why did I get into this thing? But that belief and like really coming up with ways on a daily basis to remind yourself of the power that you hold and the things that you're able to achieve. And like, I know it sounds like super cliche, but if you look at any like Oscar, like, you know, acceptance speech, or like everyone says the same thing. They're like, believe in yourself. Because that's really the difference in between being successful or not, right? It's like, sometimes it takes one person, two people, three people to tell you can't do something for you to give up on it. And a lot of the people that, you know, get this Oscars and like win awards or like change the world, they're like, imagine if I had heard that wanker that told me that I couldn't do it and I would have never done it. And like, I've had this experience, like before Alexis invested in my company, I had 147 no's. 147 professional investors told me that my idea was not worth investing in. Imagine if I had stopped. Imagine if I had like, so to me, like the second, and I had a boyfriend at the time that even he didn't believe in me. Like when I was trying to get Alexis, he was like, I've shared this story before where he was like, why are you like wasting time with like one of the best investors in the world? And I was like, why shouldn't
I? Because I believe in myself.
Exactly. And I was like, it almost became a thing that it fueled me where I was like, I'm going to prove you wrong.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I wouldn't suggest that's where you go, like you look at things, because when you, it's a very negative way of trying to do stuff when you were trying to prove everyone wrong. But the reality, and I have like a good friend of mine who's an investor who said that to me like recently. He's like, you know, the best founders I've ever invested in are the ones that had someone in their life that told them that they couldn't do something. And that's it. And then they become successful.
I wish people could see your face right now. You're like, oh. Try me. Test me.
Well, I mean, I have my moments. Like, I'm not like this all the time. I don't feel like, especially now that I'm pregnant and I go by it like this, you know, a lot of emotions.
Hormonal roller coaster.
Yeah, yes. But ultimately, I think it's there. And I know there's a reason why everyone that is successful tells you about this. Oh, don't ignore it. It's not minor.
Yeah. Hey, can we actually talk about the topic of pregnancy? I mean, it's super personal. I don't want to cross any border here, but clearly it would be super interesting for any woman trying to aspire or trying to, you know, maybe reach a C-level position, how to deal with the situation, because clearly you're going to be out of your job naturally for a certain amount of time. You are facing difficulties and aversion without being pregnant in this industry already. And this is adding like a whole nother sphere of difficult conversations with employers, with business partners. How has your experience been?
It was really in my head. And I think that we're lucky because a lot of women gone through this and changed this for us to feel more comfortable. But I did feel like, I remember when I found out I was pregnant, I was like, the first thought was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I've always wanted to be a mom. Second thought, oh my God, what am I gonna think of work? And I remember feeling so like pissed that I had to even feel that way, you know? Like, I was like, why do I, like, I have to be embarrassed about, you know, like becoming a mom? Like, this is just doesn't work. And I, like, in my mind, I was like, I never want my daughter to ever feel this way. Like, I have to change this. And like, you know, ultimately it's, things have changed, and like women be like pregnant women are very protected by the law, which is great. That was not the case for forever. But I think that ultimately it's also the way that you approach it. Like, are you embarrassed about it? Are you like, and so, you know, I had a few, you know, I waited 3 months, which is the normal amount of time. And in those 3 months, I went from like, oh my God, what are they gonna say? No. I never feared I was gonna be like fired, but I was like, well, are they gonna think that I'm like, not good? They're not gonna give me responsibility because they think I'm gonna leave, and then, like, what's gonna happen? To, you know what, I'm a woman, I'm like, I can recreate, that's like a great thing about me, and I'm not gonna feel bad about it. And
hell yeah,
you know, I want to work, and you know, my intention is to be active until the end of the pregnancy. And you know, obviously with understanding that my body is doing something that is a bit intense, and so I need to make sure that I can, you know, rest and not travel as much and not like do as much as before, but still be very efficient. And you know, a friend of mine told me this. She's like, I love hiring women that are coming back from their maternity leave because they're the most efficient human beings you'll ever come across.
Which a man has never said ever in this world, I think. But great.
Well, no, I'm sure that some men that like have actually paid attention to it will agree with it. And it's true, because the thing is that you don't, like, obviously you're now in charge of something, you know, big.
Bigger.
And, like, and so your time is limited. So you're going to get the work done like when you can. And so, yeah, I think it was a very personal thing for me, and like I feel a lot of people is the same. They're like, they have all these ideas, and like I remember when I actually ended up telling my boss, he was like, oh, that's great news, awesome, great, cool, have you done this thing about yesterday, like, you know, like,
okay, perfect. So it was like, that's great.
So I had a good, I mean, obviously I can't speak for every woman, I had a good experience. But I think that it's really the way that you approach, it's like the negotiations, right? It's the way that you approach the subject. Like, what you believe is true, and like, no one else should be able to convince you otherwise. Like, if anyone wanted to shame me about my pregnancy, I was ready to punch back. Like, that was, I was like, I'm 31 years old. Like, I've waited my whole life for this moment. Like, you're not going to take it away from me. And so, yeah, I guess that.
Nice.
Hopefully
one.
It's a good answer.
It's a great answer. And actually, one of the things that you said will lead us to our last category. You said you can't travel as much. You're going to stay at home. And the last category is a little shootout. So I'm going to shoot you a handful of short questions, which you have to answer right away.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
First one is, travel or stay at home?
Stay at home.
Oh, really? I wouldn't have imagined for you to answer that.
No, stay at home. Yeah.
I mean, I can see a little bit of your home right there. It's beautiful. Yeah. So
yes.
I can imagine.
If you asked me like a few years ago, maybe I would have said travel, but now I'm like, stay at home.
Perfect. Everything at its time. Second one, favorite football club?
Racing. Mm-hmm. And Fulham. Now.
Nice. The most important app on your phone right now?
WhatsApp?
No. Is it?
Mm-hmm.
You're a WhatsApp person.
Yes.
Office or home office?
Home office, forever and ever.
Oh, really? I'm not a home office person. I'm distracting myself. I need people around. Next one. Ronaldo or Messi? I'm kidding. Kidding. Not really asking that one. Nope. Doing everything by yourself or delegate stuff at times?
Delegate stuff, of course. You can do a lot more. Yeah.
That's true. Something that you would like to get better at?
So many things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
hit a spot there.
Yeah. Sorry. No, it's not being rapid on my side.
Take your time.
I would love to get better at working in a corporate environment. There you go.
Oh, that's a nice one. Okay. And the last one would be head or gut decisions?
Gut decisions, always.
Oh, really? That's the one that I struggle with most. You just feel the answer in your gut and you just go with it?
Yes. Yes, because every single freaking time I've ignored my gut, it came and bit me in the ass. It just happens.
Yeah, I feel
it. So now I'm like, I obviously hear my head, but I also want to make sure that my gut is okay with whatever I'm about to do.
Like that one.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty, that was the shootout. And Vic, we're coming towards the end of our conversation as well. It's been, and I could keep on speaking forever. I have so many questions that I have not asked yet, but I don't know, we don't want to overwhelm everyone with like a 2-hour episode, I guess. I am always finishing up my conversations here with giving the word back to you, to our team member, the new one, and asking them to give a little pep talk to our listeners to make sure that they're not giving up on their dreams, whatever that is, and that they're following through, spreading their wings.
I feel like this entire podcast, and I love it, but has been a one long pep talk.
It definitely has been.
And I think that we underestimate the need of pep talks in life sometimes, which is like when we get lost in our own head, in our own thoughts, and we just go paths that are not constructive in any way. And I love that, you know, this is a reminder that there's always a way out of there, and it's in your hands. You can snap out of something very quickly. And I think that instead of hating feeling lost or feeling like you're not strong enough or good enough to do something is only evidence that you're in the right path. Because if you felt everything was okay all the time, then probably whatever you're doing is not that hard. And anything really worth doing in this life is never going to be easy. So if you're feeling lost, you're feeling, you know, you've come back and someone that you care about told you that you can't do whatever you want to do, or just like remember that it's just part of the journey. It's part of it.
Thank you so much, Victoire. This has been an amazing hour with you. I'm beyond grateful, really. I've learned so much myself. All the best for you, for your little girl, for the new project. I will have my eye on you for sure. And yeah, thank you so much for being part of this team here.
Thank you very much for having me, Lisa, and we can always do a part 2. Yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of stuff to talk about.